This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The bigger picture on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning and welcome to Health and Living. I'm Sharmila Ganesan. On the 16th of March, Bandar Kuching MP Dr. Kelvin Yee found out that he had COVID-19 and he was admitted for treatment in the Sarawak General Hospital. So what is it like being a COVID patient and what did his experience reveal about our healthcare system? Dr. Kelvin Yee is joining us live on the line to share his personal story. So do send us your questions and thoughts if you have any. You can call us at 03-7733-2900. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. So Dr. Kelvin is on the line. How are you doing, Dr. Kelvin?
Good morning. I am doing well. How are you?
I'm okay. Carrying on. It's a Friday, so I get to spend the weekend isolating myself, I suppose.
That is good to hear.
So what have you been doing to spend this MCO period? What's it been like for you?
It has been an interesting period. As you correctly said, I was actually admitted to the Sarawak General Hospital isolation ward on the 16th. And I was actually warded in isolation for about a week before they tested me twice in a span of 24 hours. And my results came back negative in both those tests. And then I was allowed to be discharged from the hospital. But of course, with precautions, where I need to spend a period of self-isolation back home as well until the 2nd of April, where I took a third swab to be extra sure that the virus is still not in me. So from that results, that showed that they're still negative. So I was allowed to, of course, go out to do necessities and be outside in the world again.
And what have you been doing to pass the time?
I've actually been busy because, as I said, when I was in the hospital ward, one of the opportunity that I had was to see our medical frontliners work on a daily basis. And I have many friends and ex-colleagues that are still in the medical line that are referring me cases, especially needs of the hospitals, equipment, PPEs and different things. So I've been sourcing through public donors, through different people, and also to find sources to bring it into Sarawak. Because a logistic issue is a huge issue in Sarawak. We need to fly it to Sarawak. So that is things that have been keeping my time, as well as, of course, me trying to serve my constituency. There are a lot of poor and needy that are badly affected by the MCO, people losing their income, people that have no food to eat, even people calling me saying that they don't have milk for their one-year-old child. So these are the things that we have been trying to arrange and to make sure that those needs are being met, those hurts are being healed. In the areas that we are in.
So we'll get back to that a little later, but I would like to know about you being diagnosed with COVID. You know, how did you come to get tested in the first place? And what was this process like for you?
Basically, on the 14th of March, I received the news that my colleague, the MP for Sirike, YB Andrew Wong, was tested positive for COVID-19. And because of that, I mean, the moment I knew, I cancelled all my public appointments and my meetings, and I had a consultation with the health department. So then that is where they asked me different questions to actually determine the different criteria of my contact with him. Was I speaking face-to-face with him for more than 5 minutes? Was I in an enclosed room with him for more than 15 minutes and different issues stuff like that? So after those different criteria that has been checked, They decided that it was better for me to be tested. At that period of time, I was actually asymptomatic. I had no typical symptoms of the disease. I had no fever, cough, sore throat, or even a flu. But due to the nature of my job, me meeting a lot of people in public, so they felt that it was better for me to be tested. So on the 15th, I got tested. I did a throat swab or for RT-PCR, where they test the virus load in the throat. It was rather an uncomfortable actually testing process because they stick in like a long cotton butt and kind of scrape some things off the throat. So it gives you that gagging sensation every time they do that. Yeah.
And at what point did you actually start exhibiting symptoms? I'm curious. And were they particularly difficult to go through?
Actually, for me, I was rather blessed because even through that whole period, I did not display any typical symptoms of disease. I did, in the isolation ward every day, the doctors and the nurses come in at least twice a day to take my vital signs, my blood pressure, my SpO2, which is the oxygen level in my blood. They did lung auscultation. They took an X-ray the moment I entered to monitor for signs of pneumonia, which is the most common complication of the virus, and also of my temperature and so on. And that whole 1 week, I actually displayed normal vital signs, strong vital signs. So my auscultations were clear. My X-rays were clear. So I was rather blessed. I did not display any symptoms. But of course, there are patients that have more severe or more heavy symptoms. I think the most common complication, as mentioned, is pneumonia. So pneumonia affects the functions of your lungs, the cells of your lungs. So it affects the ability to produce oxygen and to absorb carbon dioxide. Absorb oxygen and release carbon dioxide. So people feel very difficult to breathe. So, but I'm very blessed I did not have to go through the experience, but I feel for those that had to.
Could you expand a little bit also on the kind of daily care that is required for a COVID patient?
Again, it depends on the situation, on the symptoms, and also the discretion of the doctors. Like for me, besides the daily monitoring, I was in isolation ward, so there was a CCTV in my room, so they can respond in case of any emergency or any cry for help. For me, there was no specific medications prescribed for me because of I did not display any symptoms. The only advice the doctors gave me was to rest, as well as to stay hydrated, to drink more water. And this is to boost our immune system, not because warm water kills the virus. But in general, I think the main fighting or the main line of defense for every one of us is actually our immune system. That is why we need to practice a healthy lifestyle. But for certain patients, they are treated based on their symptoms and the stage of the progression of the disease. Most of them are treated for the pneumonia. Some, I heard, has IV antibiotics to treat the pneumonia due to different other secondary infections. Of course, I think now Malaysia has been chosen by the WHO to run a trial medicine, which has been effective in some countries. I think some of the people that I know, some patients that I know, have been given hydroxychloroquine, which is the anti-malaria drugs, which has seen good effects in countries like France and also even the US. So it depends, again, on the discretion of the doctors and also the stage and the symptoms the patient is facing.
But of course, as a patient, there's also an emotional component to all this, right? What was it like for you? Were you scared?
To be honest, the moment I heard that I was tested positive, I think I was filled with this overwhelming worry and concern. Mm. But at first, it was not so much of on myself or my health, but it's a lot of course my wife, my family, on how they're going to take the news. And due to the nature of my job, how will the public react to my news?
Right.
Because I was very concerned that it will, of course, trigger a minor panic. And we know that a panic is not helpful in such situations. And of course, the moment the news broke out, it did trigger some good encouraging response, some not so good, and some really bad ones as well. But this all counts in the site. This all puts a toll, or even on my psyche, on my emotions, because at the end of the day, no patients want to be, number one, wants to get the disease. Number two, no patient wants to infect another person and jeopardize the life of not just the other person, but the lives of the families close to them and also their loved ones. So all this puts a toll on us and also on our psychological health. Mm.
And, you know, to be very candid, you must have come into contact with a number of people before you were diagnosed, because this was also before the MCO was implemented. You know, did you feel a sense of anxiety about this, and how did you work through these feelings?
That is why, as I said, the first reaction I felt when I found out was the overwhelming concern for the public. Mm. Because even though there were some bad comments or hurtful statements being made, but I've never blamed them, because I understand the concerns that, or even the confusions that they have. As I, due to the nature of my job, I attended many events, even a school event, where parents naturally are very concerned and protective of their children. So in response to that, of course, the easy one to blame is the person. Well, it's basically me. But again, how I comfort myself or how I tell myself on a daily basis is I didn't want this. I didn't know I was sick. I didn't display any symptoms during that whole period. And if I knew I was sick, I would never have been in public. I would never have jeopardized the safety of anybody, of my fellow Malaysians and Sarawakians. But I had to. It's a constant reminder. I had to tell every day. I tell myself every day that it is not your fault. It's beyond your control. And the fact is, actually, one of the biggest struggle I think all patients and I heard from so many is reading the daily reports of new cases, because the greatest guilt, in psychological terms, we call this the spreader's guilt. Mm. The greatest guilt we have is the possibility of re-affecting another person out of our control. Mm-hmm. And what's worse is if that person or another contact actually passes on due to the disease. So this spreader's guilt, and another is what we call a survivor's guilt. That means if there is a possibility we spread it to another person and that person passes on, but we survive. So this is an additional emotional and psychological burdens that a lot of patients actually have to go through. Mm.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Dr. Kelvin. Now, we do need to take a quick break. But when we come back, I would like to continue this conversation about your experience. We are speaking to Bandar Kuching MP Dr. Kelvin Yee about his experiences of being a COVID-19 patient. If you have thoughts or questions that you'd like to ask him, you can call us at 03-7733-2900. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Health and Living. We will on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm Sharmila Ganesan. And today we are speaking to Bandar Kuching MP Dr. Kelvin Yee, who is a recovered COVID-19 patient. And he's sharing with us his experiences and some of his thoughts from going through this. So Dr. Kelvin, before the break, you talked a little bit about the not just your own guilt, but also that kind of stigma that you face because you've been diagnosed with COVID-19. And I'm curious about how you would urge people to behave or to respond with regard to their attitude, when dealing with others who have had COVID.
Thank you so much. I think as mentioned before, there is a lot of patients not only concerned about their health or their physical recovery from the virus. There is a lot of other concerns on how they can face the public again, how they face their colleagues and people around them, because the stigma is real. And the reality is this stigma is not just limited to the patient themselves, but also their closest families and people around them. So actually, since I was discharged from the hospital, I've been picking up a lot of calls, answering a lot of messages from patients that were tested positive, and they message and they call me and says, Kelvin, how do you cope with the stigma? How do you cope with the rumors that have been said about you? How do you cope with the unfounded allegations about us and also about our family members that are closest to us? So as I said, the stigma and the pain and the burden is real, because once a patient is diagnosed positive, we see, especially with the age of social media and WhatsApp, we see messages being spread like wildfire. Mm. Messages like untrue allegations, of course, pictures of the patient, pictures of the family of the patient, pictures of the home of the patient, pictures of the business or the working place of the patients, which are supposed to be confidential. But then it is being spread around, and people's not only just stigmatized, but they throw blame at the patients themselves, even though it is beyond their control. But I can, in a few days ago, actually, I received a phone call where a lady, she was crying over the phone to me. She said that she was actually asymptomatic. She was asymptomatic. She wasn't sick, but because she had a possible contact with what we call a PUI or a person under investigation, she took the brave step or the responsible step to go get herself tested. And when she got herself tested, she was found to be positive of the virus. She was feeling well. But the moment she informed the closest family members and people around that she was tested positive, she was ridiculed. People start blaming her and accusing, saying that she jeopardized the lives of their lives, the lives of their family and stuff like that. And it got so bad. Even from her colleagues, it got so bad that she couldn't take it, and she had to ask her superior, says, I cannot work in this environment again. I either need a transfer, I need to get out of here.
Right.
And the thing that hit me the most was she said that He said that I could have chosen not to get myself tested, but I went to get tested and I regretted doing so. Mm. You see, in this moment, especially as we as a community is trying to fight this COVID, one of the things we must really encourage is for more and more people to get tested, especially those that have been in contact with a certain clusters or certain positive patients. So you see, when we are stigmatizing, when we are throwing these accusations, what we are actually doing and the message that we are sending is we are discouraging people from getting tested. Because if I'm an external person and I see all this stigma, I see all this treatment that the patients receive, why would I then step up and do the responsible thing to be tested? So that is why I really encourage the members of the public. This is really not a time to throw blame. This is not a time to start rumors or to stigmatize. This is a time that we approach this issue with love, with care, and empathy. Because let us try to imagine ourselves in the shoes of this patient and ask ourselves, how do we want to be treated if we are in that shoes? Because you see, this virus do not discriminate. It can happen. I do not wish it on anybody, but it can happen to anybody regardless of background, race, or religion. So that is why we must approach this and through a loving and supportive environment, then we can see more people actually going to be tested. And that is a very important step that we need to encourage.
Mm. So on that note, we actually have a question for you on Twitter from Dr. Arvinder Singh. He wants to know, do you think that a support group for patients already having COVID-19 is needed due to the stigma and the fact that, as you said, the stigma that is attached is actually causing patients not to come forward for the fear of being segregated?
That's actually a very important thing to have. And that's one of the things that I'm working on with a few other professionals. It's a support group as well as a what we call a psychological first aid. This is normally done by the psychological department, psychiatrist department in the hospitals, where the psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, counselors actually receive information of patients and they call one by one of people that have been affected. As I said, this is a very traumatic season for a patient, not just on a physical side, but also on a mental side. So they do what we call psychological first aid to help them through. And as I said, I produce some videos on my public page to raise some awareness, to speak candidly about the things that we go through. And I want to hear more and more stories of our patients going out there so people will understand. There is one that came out yesterday and saying that this was a patient who suffered a loss of a family member due to the virus, and she said that dealing with unfounded allegations, dealing with accusations, it feels worse than having salt rub on your wounds, especially during a grieving period. So these are issues that we want to address and support them. So as I said, I'm open. People have been calling me to get support, to ask how I feel and how we can support one another through this. But there's much more to be done. And this has to be a collective effort by not just healthcare or psychological professionals, but the people. Because we need to heal as a nation, not just physically, but be supported in our mental health, especially when we want to recover after this whole virus. We need to recover the economy of our country. And in order to recover the economy, we need to have good productivity among our citizens and our community. And if our mental health of the community is affected, this will, of course, affect the productivity of our country.
Mm. And Dr. P.P. Lim, also on Twitter, wants to ask, how would you encourage those who are infected or may be exposed to open up and to be honest about this, as it is, you know, it is something that can save lives?
It is actually a challenge. I have actually spoken to a few editors of different portals and newsline, whether they are willing to highlight the real and raw stories of these patients. But then the highlight the stories as it is, not being framed by the media, not being framed to sensationalize, but word by word approved by the patients themselves, so that people will fully empathize with the issue. But as I said, it is a very painful period. I've spoken to some patients. They are very concerned, actually. They're very worried because of the stigma they feel already. So they say, if I don't mind, it was difficult enough to share it with me, one person, for them to share it with the world, it is another hurdle that they have to cross. And it's fully understandable. While we know the benefits of these stories going out, there is another element that we need to understand as well. Then we must give them space in order to heal and to come out when the time is right or when they're actually ready to do so. Because we can never expect or predict how the public will react to it. Actually, when I did a video on raising awareness against stigma and how we should respond, and I was there were certain quarters that, of course, criticized me and say that, what is wrong with us spreading pictures and telling people where the infected patients are? We just want to raise awareness to make sure people do not go to their houses, do not go to their businesses, do not do this. We also care about our safety and security. And while I understand to a certain extent the points that they are raising, or they raise, but then as I said, we have to think on both sides, while how we take care of our own safety, but also not put other people down, especially on the patients that have been tested positive. So that we cannot predict how things will turn out. We have to approach it in a very sensitive manner.
I think the word you used, empathy, is something that we could all practice a little bit more of.
Exactly. That's how we should approach it.
I would like to sort of step back a little bit from this, and I'm very curious to know that, because you were a patient, and so you were a part of the healthcare system that is going through so much right now. And we do know also that the purpose of this movement control order currently is to reduce the number of cases that end up in the hospitals. So from your perspective, how would you describe the capacity of the system?
I think, as I said, one of the good things that me being inside is I get to see firsthand from a different perspective from inside the healthcare system itself and the capacity. I actually took the opportunity to speak to a lot of different doctors that came in to see me on how they are feeling about that whole thing. So actually the anxiety is real, even under the medical among the medical professions, not just about the safety, whether the ability for the hospitals to control. But in all essence, I think the approach the country has taken, I think it's a bit too early for me to clearly say whether it's been effective, it's been right, because we are still in the midst of it and we have not really seen the peak yet, which I predict will be in a week or two. But then I think there have been some good hits and, of course, there have been some good misses. I think one of the major concerns the healthcare professional has expressed to me and things that I've been trying to work on this whole week is the lack of PPEs or protective units to protect not just doctors that are involved on the front lines for COVID patients, but including doctors that are in the emergency department that may see patients of other diseases, but may have the possibility to carry the virus as well, or asymptomatic patients that may carry the virus as well. So these are risks that the doctors have to face on a daily basis. And I hear many friends, ex-colleagues who are on the front lines getting quarantined because they were exposed to a patient and they didn't have the adequate protective unit. So different issues that has to be addressed, as well as the testing capacity that our country has is relatively good. But I think we should be targeting at what different countries like South Korea or Taiwan is hitting. There's more transparency in terms of the data that's been released. We have a lot of pending cases. So again, our country practices what we call selective testing. So even when, for example, I can give an example. When my news was announced that I was positive, there was a huge crowd that started gathering in the hospitals, not just in the general hospital, but also in the private hospitals, because there were concerns. People were wanting to get tested, people that had contact with me, people that attended an event with me. But the policy at hand was only if you had symptoms that you get tested. So while I understand, for example, there's serological tests and there's the RT-PCR, for serological tests, it may not be super accurate, especially if you don't have symptoms. And RT-PCR may take time, and sometimes with the lack of the reagents, we may not have the capacity to test as much as we want. But this is something we have to work on. I think the government has ordered more RT-PCR reagents like in Sarawak. I think at the end of March, the government spent $1.3 million to order this reagent to hopefully increase our testing capacity to about 1,000 to a day. We are now about 400-ish, maybe 500 a day, and we want to go up more. But in my view, I think we need to test more. This policy of purely selective or targeted testing should be loosened. I think the best way forward is to test, and have the capacity to quarantine. And it's not just about testing. Because if a patient is tested positive, they need to be quarantined. And we need facilities where there is enough to quarantine each patient. And we need manpower as well to take care of these patients. So I said many frontliners are beginning to get quarantined themselves because they were exposed to patients that, number one, they weren't forthcoming or truthful about their history. And number two, that probably didn't know they had contact, asymptomatic, or, as I said, they carry the virus and expose others with. So these are different factors that we need to do. So it's not just about testing. It's about facilities, the hardware, and also the software where the manpower is needed. Mm. So I guess, but in terms of effort, I think the frontliners, our Ministry of Health, the people have been the best. As I said, I always say that I see what keeps me positive and encouraged to keep on going is I see the best of humanity displayed in the hospitals on a daily basis. Because, you know, there are doctors that sleep at the hospital because they are afraid to go home to bring back the virus to their families. But even in this whole risky and risky situation, they come day to day without complaints and to serve and protect and to heal our patients.
Mm. Do you see a lack of equitable distribution in terms of the healthcare services? I mean, if we look at, for instance, urban versus rural or primary versus secondary and tertiary.
Yeah, of course. I think it's natural that the distribution of hardware, which is like equipment, supplies, and even workmanship, has to be done proportionate to the needs of the hospital and the clinics. Of course, I would like to see a more unified medical network where not just the public sector, but also the private sector being more involved, especially on the first line, to screen more and more patients. In the context of Sarawak, actually one of the biggest concerns that we have is whether if this virus is being spread into the rural areas, and if an outbreak, in the worst case, you know, if an outbreak happened in rural areas, the healthcare facilities in rural areas have no capacity, not only to test, but to quarantine and also to treat, especially if they are on ventilators, they are intubated and so on. So when the MCO was first ordered, a lot of instructions wasn't very clear, and actually many people started taking it as an opportunity to balik kampung, to go back to the rural areas. Mm. So this was a concern that we all had. So I said that if an outbreak happened in the rural areas, they don't have the capacity to contain it, and for them to travel to the nearest hospital in the city, in the context of Sarawak, due to our demographics, it takes more than 10, 15 kilometers, and it costs money. Which may be difficult for this for families that live in the rural areas. So of course more can be done. I'm getting a lot of calls from Klinik Kesehatan saying that they do not have enough PPEs. They need more. So that is where I think we all have a collective responsibility. Sarawak is difficult because a lot of the material supplies flew in through KL, and due to the MCO, it has affected, of course, the freight services. It has affected flights are being cancelled, only maybe once or twice a week flights fly in. So that is where there is always a gap, where there is insufficient supplies for these different hospitals or clinics.
Right. And what about in terms of the mental and emotional health of our frontline workers? I mean, you saw them firsthand. You know, how would you describe their morale, what they're going through? And what can we do to support them?
I think, as I said, I saw them firsthand, and I took every opportunity to speak to them as much as I can because I want to understand their story as well. You see, they are no different than us. They are like us. They have a family back home they're concerned of. They have elderly parents, young children back home they're concerned of. As I said, there were some that were afraid to go home. Some that were actually told me, a few frontliners told me that their family actually kind of to a certain extent stigmatize that and say, don't come home now, you sleep in a different area. So while we understand the concerns of those family, but there is a sense of rejection felt by even our frontliners, by people closest to them. So they are also going through a lot of anxiety and pressure on top of the stress, high stress period that they're going through treating the patients. So I think the best way that actually we can help them is actually to stay home, is to practice social distancing. Sometimes the simplest thing said may be the hardest thing to do, but may have the biggest impact. So by not swarming or overwhelming the healthcare system, by being truthful with our history of our contact to the doctors, that itself actually helps so much. You have no idea how much anxiety and to a certain extent anger the doctors feel every time they find out that the patient has not been honest to them, especially in this high stress time. So while I understand some patients, they don't want to be stigmatized, so they try to hide certain things. But as I said, this is not a time to protect ourselves, but let us together protect the community. And this includes our frontliners. So let's support them in any way we can. If we know any one of them, message them, encourage them, thank them. This is not a time to find faults. Actually, a lot of people have asked me what can be improved in the hospital. But for me, as I said, of course, there are some misses, but I believe that in terms of efforts done by them, they are doing above and beyond what I think is expected of them. So we give them credit. We need to support them. And of course, stay home. As we stay home, we try to flatten the curve so that the frontliners and the doctors are not overwhelmed with too many COVID patients, because there are other diseases, there are other patients that still need to be treated. And I'm also concerned on the morbidity and the mortality rate of other diseases once this whole COVID season is over.
So on that note about staying home, do you, however, have concerns with the movement control order? I mean, we know it's a necessary move, but, you know, who's falling through the cracks, particularly, let's say, in your constituency?
I think MCO affects everybody. But then it has different intensity to different groups, especially those most marginalized groups. I think, for example, the poor, the odd job workers, the daily paid workers, they have lost their sense of their income during this MCO because they cannot go out to move. Or even hawkers in markets have lost maybe 50 to 60% of business before, and they struggle to put food on the table. In the rural areas as well, food was difficult to be sent in due to the MCO. So different issues that the MCO has affected different people. So that's why we try to fill in the gap. At first, the government policy they didn't allow NGOs or anybody to send it except Jabatan Kebajikan Masyarakat or the Welfare Department to do so. So we tried to play our part. We tried to submit names to the Welfare Department on the families that really need. But then we understand maybe the ministry was overworked, they didn't have enough capacity. So the whole food aid was delayed. And because of that, people were starving. So we had no choice but to respond to those really urgent needs. I mean, if you get a call from a father crying, saying that my baby has no milk to eat, to drink, that moves you in all kinds of ways, and you know how you have to respond. I think 3 days ago, I sent food to a really poor family in my constituents. And then I think about six, seven-year-old toddler ran up to me and says, Abang, saya nak minum susu. I want to drink milk. Mm. And then I said, sure, we brought some milk powder for you and we passed it to him. I mean, the joy in his face, he held the milk powder box. He ran to his younger sister and says that, yay, hari ni kita ada susu nak minum. So today we have milk to drink. Mm. I mean, hearing this, sometimes the ability to have social distancing or stay home sometimes is a privilege. But some people, they don't have that capacity or to go on a day-to-day basis in this MCO because of the loss of income and everything. So hearing stories like that, and there are many others, actually breaks you. Mm. And strengthens you to find measures or solutions to help them through, because we all need to do it together. Another group that is very vulnerable is actually the construction workers, migrant workers that stay in temporary workers' quarters, which we know are not in the best conditions. I think 2 days ago, I went and sent food to a construction quarters. There were about 20 families staying there. Majority were from the rural of Sarawak, and they said they have been surviving on tepung gandum or wheat flour, and also salted fish for the past few days. And now they have at least rice to eat for their families, and they have kids.
Right.
So see, these are people that are marginalized, that are really more affected by the whole MCO.
Mm-hmm.
So that is why, as I said, we need to approach this empathetically. Understand that people are affected by MCO. When we call for an extension of MCO, I personally feel it's needed, but then we also must look into all the different spheres so that nobody falls beyond the cracks and have to suffer even more or die because of other reasons other than this virus.
So we do. We are running out of time, but as you just mentioned, you know, the government is due to announce soon whether or not the MCO will be ending next week. Any final message on what we should prepare for and what we should think about in terms of our own behaviours and practices?
I think the main message that I've been trying to send is actually that this is we are in this together. We need a collective effort to fight this virus together. Every department, every sector or community should be seen as a health sector. That means it is not just the frontliners, but we, the citizens, should be as well part of the health sector and to contribute to it. And as I said, the easiest thing is to stay home, to abide by the MCO. And if the Prime Minister announces it soon, then we will follow along what is needed. And also to not stigmatize, to not send accusations, but to be empathetic, loving and caring, because this is a marathon. This is not a 100-meter sprint, and our country will need time to recover from this, the impact of the virus. And we need our citizens healthy, not just physically, but supported through their mental health so that the productivity of our country actually increases after this trying time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kelvin, and I wish you the best of health.
Thank you so much, and I wish you the best too.
Thank you. And we've been speaking to Bandar Kuching MP Dr. Kelvin Yee, who found out that he had COVID-19 and was admitted for treatment in Sarawak General Hospital. Well, that is all from us today on the Health and Living show. And I think if anything we can take away from this is really to practice empathy. Here's wishing you guys all the best. Stay safe, stay at home. This is Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.